The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. Exploring ideas with innovators, change makers, business leaders, politicians, and activists. A special feature from Vermont Business for Social Responsibility. Underwritten in part by CW Print and Design. Formerly Copy World, your local digital print shop, offering quick design and printing services for projects of all sizes. By Green Mountain Power, partnering with customers on energy transformation while delivering clean, reliable, and cost-effective power. The Alchemist, serving the greater Wataveri community and Vermont since 2003. UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. By Concept 2, designers and manufacturers of Concept 2 rowing oars, indoor rower, and ski erg. Proud to support nonprofit groups such as Local Motion, Vermont's statewide nonprofit advocate for walkable and bikeable communities. Let's Grow Kids, focusing on the first years of child development. As well as over 750 VBSR business members who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit. Learn more at www.vbsr.org.
Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Today we spend the hour talking about refugees and immigrants. My guest is Mark Hetfield. He is president and CEO of HIAS, which was founded as the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society back in 1881. It is the world's oldest organization dedicated to refugees. Mark has led the transformation of the organization from one focused on Jewish immigrants to a global agency that assists and resettles refugees of all faiths and ethnicities, and is a major implementing partner of the UN Refugee Agency and the U.S. Department of State. This year, in February, under Mark's leadership, HIAS became the first and only national refugee resettlement agency to file a court challenge against the Trump administration and its executive order implementing a Muslim and refugee ban, a challenge which led to an injunction against the order. Mark Hetfield, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you, David.
So, let's pick it up this year with the refugee bans and give us a kind of refugee ban 101. What has happened in the last year, particularly since President Trump took office?
Well, if you don't mind, I think I need to rewind just a little bit further from that to September of 2015, and that's when the entire world, including President Obama, woke up to the world refugee crisis, especially the refugee crisis emanating from Syria. But the refugee crisis really is a global crisis. Already at that point in 2015, there were more refugees in the world than at any time since the Second World War, more displaced persons than at any time since the Second World War. And this is a crisis that most countries had largely paid very little attention to until the photograph of the body of Alon Kurdi, the little Syrian refugee boy who was found dead on the beach in Turkey after trying to escape to Europe with his family, was photographed and on the front page of every newspaper and on every news web page. That really woke up the entire world. It woke up the Jewish community. It woke up communities of faith. It woke up President Obama. And we started paying attention to the refugee crisis. And so after many years of this country resettling just 70,000 refugees per year, President Obama increased the refugee ceiling, which is the decision of the president, which the president needs to make every year. He increased it to 85,000 for 2016, and then 110,000 for 2017. And then President Trump took office, and within less than a week after being in office, he issued his executive order, his refugee ban, travel ban, Muslim ban, however you want to refer to it. And that would have stopped all refugees from coming in for at least 120 days and lowered that number to 50,000. That was challenged in court. The courts declared that most of his ban looked unconstitutional and illegal. So he made a second attempt at it in March. That, too, was found to be basically an illegal ban, which was incredible because never before had the president's authority regarding matters of immigration or refugees been questioned successfully in court like that. And now we're afraid he's coming at it for a third time. In September, he's required by law to set the number of refugees who can come in next year. And there was talk about him lowering that number to 50,000, which would be the lowest number since the Refugee Act was passed in 1980, so the lowest number in over 37 years. But there are apparently forces in the White House that are advocating for an even lower number, as low as 10 or 15,000, which is basically nothing for a country of our size, for a country that was basically founded by refugees and immigrants. So we're very, very concerned that he is continuing to try to really destroy the refugee program, and we're not going to let him succeed.
You have been deeply involved in refugee resettlement, but not so much in suing the United States president. What led Hayes to file suit, to join a suit in February of this year against the president?
Well, it's true. I mean, we're accustomed to going to court against the government because we represent asylum seekers who are in deportation proceedings, who are in removal proceedings. But of course, there we are representing somebody else. And this was the first time, to our knowledge in history, that Hayes has been a plaintiff in a case against the U.S. government, let alone the president. What makes this particularly precarious for us is that the United States government is our partner. I mean, they have been our partner for 37 years. They help fund us to welcome refugees. We work very closely with them and have a great collaborative relationship with the Department of State and Homeland Security, and as well as Health and Human Services. I mean, this is a partnership. And now it's a partnership where the president of the United States wants to see it end. And yet, in the meantime, we have to continue to work together with the U.S. government to welcome refugees while we're in a battle that's existential to the refugee program.
Explain the partnership that people may not understand. I mean, the State Department does not settle refugees. They provide, they're sort of the legal gateway, but they leave it to partner agencies. In Vermont, it's the Vermont Refugee and Resettlement Agency. And you're saying, and Hayes is one of those entities.
Right. So there are 9 national refugee resettlement agencies, and there have been 9 since the Refugee Act was passed in 1980, which created the structure. And 1980 was a year when there were great refugee flows coming to this country. There were large numbers of Soviet Jews in 1979 going into 1980, even larger numbers of boat people from Indochina. And then there was also the Cuban boat lift, the Marielita. So there were 3 refugee crises that the U.S. had to cope with at once, and they had no system for dealing with this. So it developed a system in the Refugee Act of 1980. In that system, it like so many other things that we do well in this country, it was all about a public-private partnership. In other countries, in Europe, for example, the government does everything. But in this country, we are the government partners with private entities. 6 of us are faith-based. Hayes is the only Jewish one. The other 5 are all Christian agencies. And then 3 secular agencies, including what is now U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, which is the partner here in Vermont, USCRI. And so those 9 agencies actually do all the work. We're the ones who meet the refugees. We decide where the refugees are going, what cities they're going to, what communities they're going to. We meet them at the airport. We find them a home to live in. We make sure that the rent is paid for that home, generally for the first 3 months. We get the kids enrolled in school. We give the family cultural orientation. We teach them basic English and do our best to get them employed as quickly as possible. And that really is the main goal of the U.S. refugee program, and that's how we look at success, is how quickly can you get the heads of family employed? Because to us, That's really the greatest engine of social integration. That's the best way to learn English. It's the best way to become an American. And then ultimately, 5 years down the road, we help these refugees become citizens. Now, back to your original question as to why we sued the administration. It's because we felt we didn't have any other alternative. We did not have a particularly sympathetic Congress. We certainly did not have a sympathetic president when it came to refugees. And so our only recourse were the courts. And we, frankly, were nervous about it because we realized that never before had a president been successfully challenged on any decisions that he had made on concerning refugees, because the president has basically great power to decide who comes in and who does not. But we made the argument with the ACLU and the National Immigrant Law Center as our attorneys, as our partners in court, that this refugee ban was the president implementing his campaign promise of a Muslim ban, which is unconstitutional and illegal. And furthermore, the president did not follow the proper procedures. I mean, while the president has a lot of authority, there are certain processes that he has to go through to set a refugee admissions number and to make those decisions. And he simply did not follow those processes. He did not consult with Congress in any way, for example, which is a requirement. And by the way, he's required to consult with Congress for refugee admissions for next year. But he hasn't done that yet. We're waiting for him to do it, but he hasn't yet done it.
Hmm. You're listening to the Vermont Conversation, and my guest this week is Mark Hetfield. He is the president and CEO of HIAS, the world's oldest organization dedicated to refugees. Mark, so the so-called Muslim ban that Trump implemented when he first came in was a ban on refugees from 7 countries, correct? Or was it a ban on all refugees?
Right. So the travel ban was a ban on people from 7 countries. The refugee ban was actually against all nationalities. It was a total ban originally.
And that was at the same time?
Yes. That was the same executive order. So no refugees could come in, period. And then on top of that, other types of immigrants and temporary visitors from those 7 countries could not come in. Then on top of that, in the original executive order, there was a ban on Syrians. So they were singled out twice. They were one of the 7 countries, but then they were specifically singled out saying that while the other 7 countries could, while the other 6 countries could come back in as early as 90 days later, Syrians could not, either as refugees or through any other means of coming to the U.S. That ban was to be until the president himself rescinded it. So that was a particularly onerous one, especially because Syrians are right now the largest refugee population in the world, constituting 20% of all displaced persons in the world.
You've essentially dedicated much of your life to working with refugees. Why do these nativist appeals to ban refugees have such resonance in the population to the degree that they do? And of course, that's debatable. But
it's hard for me to explain that, but I'll try. And I'll say one of the reasons it's hard is because for the most part, the American Jewish community, which is my community, which is the community that supports HIAS, has been overwhelmingly supportive of welcoming refugees. They want to make sure that it is done, that there's security vetting, which there is, which is already done in an extreme fashion, and has been really since September 11th, with constant enhancements made since 2001. But the American Jewish community and the congregations that I've dealt with are extremely supportive of refugees. But I can understand what's going on in this country, because there are many people who feel marginalized, who feel like like the American economy has more or less passed them by. And what has been done in recent years is some have scapegoated refugees and immigrants as being responsible or partly responsible for this. There's the often repeated myth that Trump kept saying, for example, that that undocumented immigrants get more benefits than veterans do, right? That's not true in any sense of the word. That's not even remotely truthful. There's not even a little tiny kernel of truth in that statement. But that's the type of scapegoating that we've seen happen over and over again, which turns our own marginalized people against refugees who are marginalized people, and creates this unhealthy, scapegoating, unwelcoming dynamic. And that's what we have to deal with, is we have to deal with issues of marginalization in our own country and confront those, but in a healthy way, not in a way which finds a scapegoat. And in this case, a scapegoat is largely refugees and undocumented immigrants. And the presidential candidates during the election, not just Donald Trump, but frankly, at the time of the Paris attacks of November 13th, 2015, I believe there were 14 Republican presidential candidates at that time running in the primaries, and every single one of them said that Syrian refugees or Syrian Muslim refugees should be banned from this country for the sake of this country's safety. Syrian refugees had nothing to do with those attacks in Paris, absolutely nothing. There was one person who was implicated in the attack who was European but had a false Syrian document. But other than that, Syrians had nothing to do with it. It was a total scapegoating exercise where politicians wanted to make people feel safe, didn't know how to do it, but they decided, well, there's an easy target, refugees, they're defenseless, they don't have a strong constituency. We'll say that they're the threat, we can keep them out, and that will make Americans feel safe. So it was a false solution to a problem. And it was particularly false because the U.S. refugee program has really become a bit of a fortress. As I said, no immigrant group going to any country in the world is vetted to the extreme that refugees coming to America are vetted.
Well, give us an example. What does a refugee applying to live here have to go through?
A refugee, this used to be considered to be a rescue program, right? Not so much anymore because of the amount of time it takes to screen each and every refugee who comes here. Every refugee has to go through face-to-face interviews first with the UN, and then face-to-face interviews with an organization which is under contract with the United States government to prepare and vet refugees and prepare them for an interview. Then the refugee goes through a face-to-face in-person hours-long interview with a Homeland Security officer overseas. The fingerprints are taken of each and every refugee applicant. The biodata is taken. All that information is run against multiple international as well as national security and law enforcement databases. And on top of that, those fingerprints remain with the refugee for the rest of his life. So if he comes to the U.S., those fingerprints are still on record and accessible by law enforcement authorities. There are just multiple steps that take place. Every single refugee has to go through multiple vetting, signed off by multiple intelligence and security agencies before he or she can come to this country. And these are all enhancements that have been made over the years based on past errors and omissions. In fact, I would say this process is secure to a fault. It errs on the side of exclusion, not inclusion. So if a refugee is identified as a potential security threat, or just if a refugee may have had some contact with somebody who is viewed by the United States as a security threat, that refugee's case is flagged and pushed aside, or sometimes actually denied. The refugee is never told what the basis was for that decision. The refugee is therefore not allowed to challenge any of the evidence that was used against him or her. This is a kind of system that could not be used inside of this country because there is no semblance of due process or fairness to it. But nonetheless, one cannot say it's not a secure system. It is secure to a fault.
And how long does it normally take to get all the way through that vetting process?
18 to 24 months, I would argue. We try to be careful with that figure because sometimes it can take less time than that, and longer doesn't necessarily mean better. But nonetheless, it does take, on average, 18 to 24 months. And of course, keep in mind that many refugees never make it through that process.
So right now, we're seeing images and news stories about what appears to be an unprecedented, at least in modern times, wave of refugees that are streaming out of North Africa and the Middle East. What is going on that's causing this?
Well, the problem is that there are no orderly migration programs for refugees, or there are not nearly enough. So only 1% of the world's refugees actually get resettled to a third country, literally 1%. So out of the 23 million refugees in the world, only 1% or less of those actually get an opportunity to be resettled to someplace safe. The others have to be find a home to the first country to which they fled, or they have to wait until it's safe for them to go back to their home country. And this is just because very few countries are willing to offer significant places for refugees that need resettlement. And now the United States is leading a race to the bottom, making the number of places even less. There's been a lot of, again, false debates about how we need to spend more time and attention and funding keeping refugees safe where they are, not bringing them all here. Well, we don't bring them all here. We actually bring very, very few here, bringing 85,000 or even 110,000 refugees out of a worldwide population of 23 million refugees and 65 million displaced persons. You can see it's a very small percentage. But of course, for those tens of thousands that we do bring here, it's life-saving, because often we take the most vulnerable people, the people that really could not survive where they are for very long. And likewise, it shows the rest of the world that we are not afraid of refugees in this country, but we welcome them. And what's especially beautiful about America is that we welcome them not as refugees, but really as new Americans, that refugees have the opportunity to become American citizens 5 years after entering. It's an opportunity that nearly all of them pursue because they realize the value of American citizenship, especially since they had to run away from the last country where they were citizens. So it sends a very important message to the rest of the world, that refugees to America are viewed as an asset, as a national treasure, not as something that we should be afraid of, and certainly not as people that we should put in camps, which is what many other countries do, which truly does make refugees into a burden.
Well, you're listening to the Vermont Conversation, and we're spending the hour this week talking with Mark Hetfield. He's president and CEO of HIAS, which is the world's oldest organization dedicated to refugees. We're going to take a short break for the news, and we'll be right back to continue our conversation about refugees and immigrants. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. We're spending the hour this week talking about refugees and immigrants. My guest is Mark Hetfield. He's president and CEO of HIAS, which was founded as the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society back in 1881. It is the world's oldest organization dedicated to refugees. In February 2017, under Mark's leadership, HIAS became the first and only national refugee resettlement agency to file a court challenge against the Trump administration and its executive order implementing a Muslim and refugee ban. Mark, bring us up to date on this lawsuit against the Trump administration. Where does it stand?
Well, it's been a real ping-pong match. So I'll spare you the details in terms of each step of the way, because it keeps going from district court to circuit court to Supreme Court to circuit court to the Supreme Court again. Where it stands right now is that even though the president wanted to put a total stop to refugees from coming to this country for a minimum of 120 days, the current court ruling is that refugees who have a bona fide U.S. tie, a bona fide tie to someone or an entity in the United States, may continue to come here, notwithstanding the refugee ban. And so that that continues to be the case. We had made the argument that every refugee with a connection to an agency like HIAS had that U.S. tie, and we found support for that in the circuit court and in the Ninth Circuit. But the Supreme Court decided not to implement that; that should not be implemented. So right now, it's basically based on family relationships. And the administration tried to define family relationships very narrowly, saying that close family relationships did not include grandparents or grandchildren, for example. But the courts literally said that's ridiculous, and so now the family relationship definition is broader. So refugees with family relationships basically can continue to come to the United States, notwithstanding the refugee ban. But until the Supreme Court hears the case and then decides it, which is on October 10th, it will continue to be restricted to people with close family relationships.
So what does this mean that the United States, I mean, how many total refugees do you think are going to enter the country this year in 2017?
Well, the fiscal year is about to end, so we go by the federal fiscal year ending September 30th, and the president tried to set the number for the total for the year at 50,000. We'll probably be around 56,000 by the time September 30th rolls around. So we did go higher than he wanted to go, but this is far, far lower than the 110,000 refugees that President Obama decided we would welcome in 2017 when he set the ceiling. And I have to note that the State Department tells me that there are close to 250,000 refugees in the pipeline to come to the U.S. So somewhere in the process of consideration with live cases. So there is a large number that are trying to get here through a legal route. And that's the problem here, is the president is cutting off. People talk about the importance of legal immigration and of following the rules and of standing in line. Well, these are people, 250,000 people that are following the rules, who are fleeing for their lives but are still being patient trying to get through this legal process. And now if we cut that off, that's when you start to see what you see in Europe, which is people risking their lives, taking it upon themselves to find safety and asylum one way or the other, even without going through a legal process.
Hmm. What motivated you to begin working with refugees?
It actually started in the Soviet Jewry movement, where I was active in the Soviet Jewry movement when there were hundreds of thousands of Jews who were trapped inside the Soviet Union, who were basically being robbed of their connections to their faith and their culture. There was a cultural genocide that was going on in Soviet Russia, and it was great to be a part of this effort to bring Jews out of Russia, where being a Jew only had bad associations, where it was only a reason for people to beat you up or deny you a job. It had nothing to do with a faith, because you weren't allowed to practice your faith. It had nothing to do with a culture, because you weren't allowed to observe that culture. You had to be Soviet, not Jewish. And so to be able to take people out of that very bad situation and reunite them with Judaism, either in the United States or Canada or Australia or Israel, which is what we helped do during those days, was extremely meaningful. And it opened my eyes to the fact that we are a refugee people, and that there are many refugees in the world that don't have that opportunity. Like every Jew, thank God, since 1948, has the opportunity, if he or she wants to go to Israel. So you don't have a Jewish refugee problem anymore, the way we've had for many, many centuries. And it gave me real empathy for refugees who don't have an Israel to go through. I mean, most refugees who flee their country have no place to go, are living in very dangerous and precarious circumstances, and have no solution. So personally, I thought it very important to try to help refugees find that solution and get out of danger, because you only have one life to live, and you shouldn't have to live that life in hiding or in a refugee camp just because of who you are or what you believe or And so this refugee work has been very, very important to me. But that's the evolution of it.
Does your family, was there a history where anyone in your family was a refugee at some time?
Well, we all were. I mean, my family's been here for a long time, but let's face it, in this country, everybody has that history. Except for American Indians, all of us are refugees or immigrants, and the American Jewish community in particular. Everybody has mixed motivations to come here. It's partially partially driven by economics, maybe partially driven by family, partially driven by persecution. But the fact is that when you look at the emigration of Jews to this country, it's overwhelmingly anti-Semitism played a role. Being chased out of countries where we were played a role. And which is why it's been so important for HIAS to focus on refugees in particular, on people who are fleeing persecution. And that's the reason we say that we used to be an organization that helped refugees because they were Jewish, and today HIAS helps refugees because we are Jewish.
Why did HIAS make that switch, and when did it make that switch from just being a group that helped Jewish immigrants to being a group that helped all immigrants?
Well, all refugees.
Refugees.
Yeah.
Yes. And go ahead and explain the difference.
Yeah, so an immigrant, I mean, all refugees are immigrants, but not all immigrants are refugees. So an immigrant is someone who simply moves from one country to another and could have any number of motivations. A refugee is somebody who flees from one country to another, somebody who is being persecuted because of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or social group. And who cannot survive or whose human rights will not be respected in their own country, and so they have to leave to go to some other place. And so the evolution of HIAS was a long one, but it's one where we have we've now completed that journey, because finally we're in a privileged position where there are very few Jewish refugees in the world, which wasn't even the case when I entered this field in the late 1980s. I mean, there were lots of Soviet Jews, Iranian Jews, who needed protection. Now the number of Jews who need protection are much, much fewer. And as I said, on top of that, there is the option of going to Israel that they have. And so just over time, we realized that we have all this expertise. We have Jewish values. We have the teachings in our Torah, which tells us 36 times to love the stranger as ourselves, because we were once strangers in the land of Egypt. And so it really is a commandment. It's a commandment to love and welcome the stranger, which is repeated more times than any other commandment in the Torah. So now that we have the opportunity to focus not just on ourselves, but on others, it's not an option. It's something that we have to do. And as a Jewish refugee agency, it's something we really feel compelled to do.
You're listening to the Vermont Conversation, and we're speaking with Mark Hetfield, who's the president and CEO of HIAS, the world's oldest organization dedicated to refugees. Mark, as you mentioned, HIAS has its roots in a Jewish refugee movement that has its roots in anti-Semitism. Now we see these anti-Semitism rearing its head in the U.S. and having a president who has expressed sympathy for white supremacists, white nationalists. What does that feel like to you?
It's really scary. We're seeing a lot of things that I never thought we would see in our lifetime. You know, things that expressions of nativism and xenophobia and anti-Semitism that you might see at the museum on Ellis Island, but that you never thought you would actually see taking place. And now we see it taking place. And it's because hate feeds hate. And the roots of anti-Semitism are the same roots of Islamophobia, are the same roots of homophobia. Haters are going to hate. And once you create a safe space for people to hate, whether it's hating refugees or hating Mexicans, that hate is going to grow to other groups. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now. And we say it often starts with the Jews or it ends with the Jews. And this time it didn't start with the Jews. The anti-Semitism wasn't the first thing we saw. We saw the hateful rhetoric against refugees and against immigrants and against Mexicans in this campaign. Now we see it against trans people. And then it's coming out against the Jews. That's just to be expected.
What insight do you have about how this, you know, has come to take, cast the White House in its thrall? People like Stephen Miller, Steve Bannon, these guys are well-known white nationalists. Miller is still has the president's ear, and Miller is, in fact, Jewish. How do you square that?
It troubles me and it puzzles me, but I'm not even going to attempt to explain it. The American Jews are a refugee people, right? American Jewish history is definitely the history of a refugee people, and it's interesting how all of our references to it go back to Egypt, right, and the time of the Passover story. But that story has repeated itself so many times over 5,000 years of our history, and especially for the American Jewish community. And in the case of Stephen Miller, my understanding is his ancestors came over fleeing the very pogroms in Belarus that led to the creation of my organization, led to the creation of Hias, and his family found haven here. So I don't know why he feels it's now time to pull up the ladder. But this is, you know, we've seen this happen before, but that is certainly a minority view within the American Jewish community, because we relate to the fact that we are a refugee people.
Sometimes you'll hear the argument made by Trump and others that they're taking our jobs. What's the reality? How do you answer that?
I mean, refugees and immigrants create jobs. The jobs that they take are often jobs that Americans are not filling at an entry level, and then they end up being quite successful and entrepreneurial. And then their children do even better. I mean, the most successful demographic in America are really the children of immigrants and refugees. I could sit here for hours and rattle off the amazing contributions that refugees have made to this country. Google being one of them, WhatsApp being another of them, both of them inventions of highest clients. A refugee was my wife's oncologist and saved her life. It's just the contributions are unbelievable. And they're not just incredibly, not everybody, of course, invents Google, but they become parents, they become business owners, they become teachers, they become doctors. They contribute so much to this society. They add so much to this economy. And what we've also recognized is that we need immigration, we need refugees and immigrants to continue to grow as a country and as an economy. And this is something that Angela Merkel also realized.
The Chancellor of Germany.
Yeah, the Chancellor of Germany. It was one of her motivations, was that she realized that Germany has an aging population and didn't have an immigration policy that would replenish the workforce and the tax base. So that was one of the factors that entered into her calculation to welcome the refugees who were coming into Germany.
How many refugees is Germany accepting?
Well, not so many now. I mean, they literally accepted 2 million refugees initially, but it wasn't through an orderly resettlement program.
This is just within the last few years.
Yeah, since the crisis in 2015. But that flow has more or less stopped due to stricter enforcement of the rules within the European Union about moving onward to countries like Germany and Sweden. But she certainly took more than her fair share in terms of Europe of refugees. I mean, refugees are a tremendous benefit to every country, but they need to be distributed, right? They can't all be concentrated in one place, because every country has a maximum absorption capacity. And Germany, if not economically, certainly politically, reached that absorption capacity, because Germany's neighbors, other than perhaps Sweden, the other countries in Europe simply did not step up to the plate to exercise their obligations as Europeans to address the refugee issue as a community continental issue. And so as a result, she had to slow down the number of refugees that were coming into Germany, because the other countries simply were not pulling their weight. It was not sustainable.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Vermont Conversation. My guest is Mark Hetfield, the president and CEO of HIAS, the world's oldest organization dedicated to refugees. Mark, we're having this conversation in kind of a defensive crouch, as you're trying to, your organization is suing the Trump administration, trying to stop it from enacting these massive reductions in refugee settlement. If you were to pull out of that defensive crouch, what would an enlightened refugee policy look like, in your opinion?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, one thing that I alluded to earlier that the critics say is that we should be focusing on helping refugees be safe and secure where they are. That is absolutely true. That should be our strategy, but that is our strategy. That's always been our country's strategy. And that should continue to be our strategy, but it needs to be in a thoughtful way. It doesn't mean put refugees up in camps and give them food and plastic sheeting as they then live there for decades. Many, many refugees have been displaced literally for 17 years, 25 years. That's no way to live. We have to focus refugee policy on integrating them into local communities, on making them engines of economic development so that both they and their host communities benefit from their presence. So you need to make sure that we target assistance, humanitarian assistance, not just toward care and maintenance, but toward economic development of refugee communities and their host communities. That should be the focus of the strategy. But then there will always be refugees that simply cannot be safe in their countries of first asylum or cannot integrate there for one reason or another. And those are the refugees that we have to continue to welcome to this country and to encourage other countries to welcome as well. As I noted, we admitted 85,000 refugees in 2016. We can do so much more than that. The refugee groups have been advocating admissions of 200,000 refugees, which is not a record number. We admitted more refugees than that in 1981. We can certainly do more. I can tell you that we have many more Jewish communities that want to welcome refugees and assist in their resettlement than we have refugees to give them, than we have refugees to have them assist. The capacity of this country and the generosity of this country is enormous and is being untapped because of these artificial barriers that are being erected in Washington. And so, in sum, I would say we need to make sure that we accept a lot more refugees to this country within our capacity, and that capacity is at least 200,000 refugees, and to really pursue a policy where we make it clear that refugee assistance is not about handouts for refugees in other countries, but it's about making them a part of the local economy and a contributing part of the local economy that benefits both them and their hosts.
You've dedicated much of your life to working with refugees. What are you proudest of?
I'm really proud that this is a country that cares about refugees. And I'm proud that we have been a part of that. I'm proud that I've been at HIAS, as HIAS has gone from a refugee that helped refugees because they were Jewish to one that helps refugees because we are Jewish, that we help refugees out of Jewish values. I'm proud of my country because this year, when the president himself tried to stop the flow of refugees, there was really an uprising, both in the streets against it and in the courts, which prevented him from carrying out his campaign promises of a Muslim ban. And I guess it can all be summed up by what was chanted in the streets of Washington in the January after the first refugee ban was enacted, when you had thousands of people, not just in Washington, but in airports throughout the country, in cities throughout the country, chanting, no hate, no fear, refugees are welcome here.
Were you surprised by that?
I was really surprised, and I'm ashamed that I was, because that's who we are as a people. We're a country that welcomes refugees, and we relate to that.
Okay, is there what do you think led to that kind of uprising? What was the nerve that it touched?
I think Americans inherently understand that we all come from someplace else, and that if another government, if another president had done what this president did, we wouldn't be here. So I think we have a natural empathy to that.
Are you hopeful that things will get better for refugees?
This is cyclical. I mean, this is not the first time this has happened in our history. And that's one thing we know as an agency. In America was a very welcoming country to Jews until it wasn't. All right, from 1881 to 1921, Jews were being persecuted all over Eastern Europe, and America gave them a safe haven and an opportunity. And the American Jewish population grew from 250,000 in 1881 to about 3 million in 1921. But by then, America was sick and tired of the problems in Europe, confused the refugees who were coming to America with the problems they were fleeing from, and Congress slammed our doors shut in 1921. And in a blatantly xenophobic way. I mean, it was done to make America whiter. And what we saw, the problem is, yeah, it was cyclical, but the problem is that downturn of the cycle, that period of not welcoming refugees lasted through the Kristallnacht, through the Nuremberg Laws, through the Holocaust, through the Second World War, until we started welcoming refugees again. So I hope it doesn't take 25 years this time.
Okay. Well, Mark Hetfield, I want to thank you for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you.
Mark Hetfield is president and CEO of HIAS, the world's oldest organization dedicated to refugees. You can learn more about their work at HIAS, HIAS.org. That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. You can hear this and all shows at VermontConversation.com. I'm David Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility has presented the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, exploring ideas with innovators, change makers, business leaders, politicians, and activists. The special feature from VBSR is underwritten in part by Let's Grow Kids, focusing on the first years of child development. The Alchemist, serving the greater Waterbury community and Vermont since 2003. By CW Print and Design, formerly Copy World, your local digital print shop, offering quick design and printing services for projects of all sizes. By Concept 2, designers and manufacturers of Concept 2 rowing oars, indoor rower, and Ski Erg. Proud to support nonprofit groups such as Local Motion, Vermont's statewide nonprofit advocate for walkable and bikeable communities. By Green Mountain Power, partnering with customers on energy transformation while delivering clean, reliable, and cost-effective power. UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. As well as over 750 VBSR business members who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit. Learn more at www.vbsr.org.